We're back on the TV Talk Machine podcast, episode 10. I'm your co-host, Jason Snell. And across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, it's Tim Goodman. Hello, Tim.
Jason, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm thinking, 10 is a milestone. So every day we record this, every week, I think, wow, what an achievement.
Double digits.
Who would have guessed?
Very few.
You know what? We're going to go triple digits very soon.
We're going to start releasing 2-minute long daily podcasts just to run up the score.
Yeah.
Because why not? I want to start with some listener feedback before we move on to a topic.
Absolutely. That has proven to be a nice little feature. It's heartwarming.
That we have listeners?
Yeah. That people want to chat and they want to be hugged, like a Hallmark movie.
Hmm. Interesting.
Can you tell I'm in the holiday spirit, Jason?
I can feel it. We're mm-hmm. we're very rapidly approaching Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and the holiday spirit. I can feel it.
Mm-hmm. The first of many holidays to go down like bowling ball pins.
Wow, that's a little violent. You're knocking them down. Take that, Christmas. See you later, Hanukkah.
Yeah, the 6-10 Santa split.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Isn't it like you get the reindeer, but not Santa and Mrs. Claus? They're left there.
Right.
Okay, so we read a comment from listener Alan, who got berated because he did not identify his location in any way.
Yes,
so he's gotten back to us. He says, I yield. I'm Alan in the 415. So there
yes.
you go.
Uh-huh. The area code of record, as we say.
That's right. That is the area code of record. I always feel like a cheater because I live in Marin County, but I get to be in the 415. Marin got grandfathered into the 415.
No, you guys in your back pocket deals.
I know. Seriously.
Greasing the palms of greedy, I don't know. Who would you pay? Would you pay off the phone company or would you pay off?
It's just funny that everybody else in the Bay Area got pulled out of the 415 and Marin County's like, nope. We're staying.
Marin County, home of wealth.
Yeah, that's right. Money talks, folks. Money
you
talks.
Do the math.
Anyway, Alan in the 415, probably in San Francisco. Could be in Marin. You never know. Mm-hmm. This one's mostly to me, although he's got something for you and for me. For me, he says, I cannot believe you liked this season of Doctor Who. I found this.
I knew that was going to cause problems.
Yeah,
Jason.
it always does. I found this doctor to be a complete jerk and can't wait for him to regenerate. I would be okay with him being a jerk if they did something to justify his jerky behavior. But in my opinion, they didn't or didn't do it sufficiently. Fair enough, I say. Thank you for your comment. I really loved it. I think Peter Capaldi is a great actor. I like it when the doctor is not a, I liked Matt Smith, but he was also kind of a manic pixie dream boy. And I kind of like having a guy who's got rough edges and is showing that he's been around a long time and he's not necessarily as easy to like. You can appreciate him, but it's a little harder to understand him and like him. I like that. And Capaldi's great. He's such a great actor. He was great in the thick of it. And seeing him in this, he brings a little bit of those rough edges to it without it being like a nightmare of him just swearing at everybody. And we can all have our opinions about this. It's like why they make many flavors of ice cream.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Though. He specifically brought up that this doctor was a jerk, which, yeah, and I'm not watching because I should be, but I'm not well documented.
You're intimidated, sure.
Mm-hmm. So, but I am a huge fan of The Thick of It, and I'm a huge fan of Malcolm Tucker character played by Peter Capaldi. And I'm wondering, maybe someone who has never seen that and doesn't know what a jerk Peter Capaldi can be in character. Do you like him, this doctor, more because you like The Thick of It?
I watched The Thick of It because I knew, it was obviously well reviewed by people, including you, and mm-hmm. I knew Peter Capaldi was going to be on Doctor Who, and I was like, okay, I need to watch this. And, he is, he's so great in that and angry and foul-mouthed, and he's just so great. And I don't know. I mean, he brings I'm surprised at how much of that he's brought to Doctor Who. Not the swearing, obviously, because it's a family show, but some of those rough edges that this is a cranky old man doctor a little bit. And I think that earns those moments where he shows some wonder or some humanity or any of those moments, they feel so much more earned when they're coming from somebody who's gruff some of the time rather than somebody who's mostly just friendly all the time. I had a boss when I was an intern at a TV station in San Diego, and the guy was like, he never said anything. He was just super grumpy. And one day he walked up to me with a piece of copy I had written, and I'm like, oh, no. And he was like, this is good copy. And he walked away, and I'm like, oh, okay, so that's how that works. It was pretty effective. Like the rare drop of praise from somebody. And I feel like Capaldi's a little bit like that, where he's got so much dynamic range with the emotional state of that character that when it's when he does turn it on and there's that moment of kind of joy or marvel or something, you're like, oh yeah. Whereas if everything was great, then it wouldn't be so much. But I totally get how one of the beauties of Doctor Who and having all these different leads over time is, you know, you have your favorites, and the same, you know, basically. Alan in the 415 is exactly right. If you wait long enough, he's going to be gone and there'll be another guy in there.
Exactly. So my question, though, is I got this because I can ask this on the podcast because I don't have to, like, get a billion emails. But, those are stupid. So that's great. So I can ask this. Because I'm kind of fascinated now because I like the idea of, like, an older doctor who's earned it, who's been around. So this is what I don't even get. So very basic question. Do people other than the doctor in the world of Doctor Who know that the doctor turns over and is different people?
Yes, sort of. Like his current co-star, traveling companion, who's Jenna Louise Coleman as Clara, she saw him regenerate, but she also, there was a plot where she basically had to go back in time and help out previous doctors, and they did some CGI kind of stuff to put her in scenes with,
oh, nice.
Across for the 50th anniversary. That was sort of part of the premise of the 50th anniversary. And then in the 50th anniversary episode, she meets three of them. There's John Hurt as the sort of one-time doctor, and then David Tennant and Matt Smith. And so she's well-versed in it. She gets it. And I think that's actually kind of rare that you get somebody who totally gets it, but there are people around, people who work for the unit, like paramilitary organization that he works with. Sometimes they've had a relationship with him going back whatever 30 years, so they all are aware of that. So it's not a secret. But then, you know, if you meet somebody new and you don't tell them, then and it happens, then it's a surprise. But it's not meant to be a super secret thing.
Okay, so you could, in the world of Doctor Who, know that there have been previous different doctors.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, sometimes they do jokes like that where there's like a tapestry or something that's got different faces on it. Or Matt Smith had a library card and it had a picture of the first doctor on it.
Nice.
A little black and white picture from 1964. So, yeah. I think if you wanted to give it a try, this season would be a good thing to try because it's essentially, when you start with a new doctor, it's got a new feel and there's not a lot of baggage left over. So if you wanted to give it a go just to see what it's all about.
I'm going back. I'm going back to the reboot.
Yeah, well, 2005 is not a bad place to start. And the first, I'd say the first Christopher Eccleston episode is good. The first Matt Smith episode is a good jumping on point. And the first Peter Capaldi is a good jumping on point.
Was Christopher Eccleston the rebooted for next doctor?
Yeah, it was the 2005.
Okay.
He did one season and was great, but that was very much like, we'll make this deal where this really great film actor who's never going to agree to be on a show for 5 years, he'll give us one good year and it'll either work or it won't. And
that's
it worked.
That's great. Okay, good. All right. I'm starting.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, there's some rough episodes in there with farting aliens, but, you know, all in all, it won me over. So.
You never know. I might like that.
You might. You might
Didn't
like the
work for
aliens.
The Millers, but hey.
So anyway, Alan, that's my half of Alan in the 415. He says, speaking of anti-heroes, Tim, do you think the Americans qualifies? He says, call me provincial, but I bailed after, I'm not sure that's the right word. Well, maybe. I bailed after a few episodes because I found myself actively rooting against the protagonists because they were plotting against the USA. 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 So,
well,
are they anti-heroes?
They're not. They are not anti-heroes. I don't think so. No. Not classically. But the feeling that he has is a good one. I mean, I think they want you to have that because I think it adds to the unnerving sense of what's going on in the series.
So it's the uncomfortableness of the fact that they're Soviet agents.
Right, and that you would be liking them as characters, and yet that they're Soviets and they want to bring the destruction of the, you know, the great United States down. They're from the evil empire, and we're the great United. Clearly, you know, we are the good guys in this. I'm joking there. So I think that there are times when I still get that feeling where it's like, oh boy, you know, it's a tough one. But what's good about that too is that they let the husband have conflicts about wanting to be in this country. And like, I mean, that was part of season one. It's like, you know what? We could really just sell out right here and just, we've got a great little setup. We could go into the witness protection program. They would protect us. We can turn over our secrets and we'll live a great life. And I think that's part of the American dream that weaves into Philip. But you don't get that sense unless you realize, okay, right, this guy is against the United States. So that uncomfortable feeling he got is supposed to be there. But I don't really consider them anti-heroes, though.
Well, and they're representing a larger thing with the mm-hmm. Soviet Union, and yet they've got their own personal conflicts. And you can root for somebody as a person, even if they're maybe representing something. Also, it helps that the Cold War is over, and also that we won, essentially.
We won. Right.
And so it's like, you know, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, things are going to work out.
Yeah,
it's funny because we just brought that up, and I just joked about the Millers and the farting sequence. Mm-hmm. Who we see the crossover star there, Margot Martindale. I really hope. I just want to throw this in that because the Millers is being canceled. Or has been canceled, that Margot Martindale will one day be able to get back into the Americans where she belongs.
All right.
There you go.
Thank you, Alan in the 415. We got a good one here from a long-time listener. It's Larry, Mr. Vale, doing great in the 408.
Doing great. Doing great in the 408.
Yeah, he's in the Vale, Sunnyvale, in the 408. Mr. Vale. And he says, you would think that Fox would have learned its lesson with the Grace Point Broadchurch attempt, but the announcement to remake Luther for the U.S. market seems at best ill-advised. Why do networks think it's better to attempt to remake successful foreign series instead of just attempting new original television? Is it because most of the story arc and script work is done and they can just focus on recasting, even though any existing series fans will probably vilify any attempt of a remake? So that's Mr. Vale. And then also Jake in the 714 had the same question. Any chance that the Luther remake could work, or is it just going to be broadchurched? let's make that a word now.
Ooh.
It's going to be like broadchurched.
It's going to be broadchurched. Yeah, that's like saying that it's Mulaney'd.
Yeah. It's unfair to broadchurch. It should be like grace-pointed.
Yeah, it should be grace-pointed, right, yeah. Ooh, good questions. And I like the fact that we've, you know, they're 500-something miles apart in the 408 and the 714.
Jake in the 714 is lucky that we're even reading his questions, because his Twitter avatar is a Dodger hat.
So he could be in – well, he's probably still in L.A. I don't think he's probably in Anaheim because he might be an Angels fan. Right. Who knows? In Oakland, and I'm not an A's fan, so there you go. But to the question, I have struggled, Larry, with trying to figure out like why they're doing this. In particular, I've struggled separately as a whole with what the hell is going on at Fox under this new management. I mean, that it's unbelievable. It's just a lot of people covering their asses, and I think they have like basically a three-headed monster there now, and I don't know what they're doing. They just greenlit an internet series that's Most Epic Fails or whatever. It's just, what are they doing in this whole Luther thing? And it's not like they don't know that Grace Point is not doing very well in the ratings right now. I mean, it's not that they can't see that. And I think that Grace Point is a perfect example of, you know, their argument. And I say they, the people who said, oh, you critics, you were the only ones who watched Broadchurch, so there was a whole gigantic bowl of people available to us, and easy pickings for an audience. But I think that their argument fails when you look at the ratings for Grace Point, because they're not great. In fact, they're pretty poor, especially in the demo. And I don't know what they expect to do with Dexter. I mean, you're not going to, I mean, Dexter. Yeah, oh my God. Well, they should do Dexter.
They should remake
it would
Dexter.
Not surprise me if they did Dexter, but of course CBS would be the one to do that. But
with Luther.
With Luther, it just it,
Luther's format's a little more open ended, though, right? I mean, they could really just turn it into it's another kind of cop show in a way that Grace Point can't.
And I think that they would do that. I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked. I just was so disgusted by the announcement. I didn't even look at the specifics of it, honestly. And this is another tangential aside here. I talked to somebody the other day about like not knowing who's in the American remake of The Return, the French series. And I was like, and they're like, really? I mean, I was like, look, I work for THR. We are obsessed by that kind of stuff, but I'm not. I don't really care about it until it comes across my desk in a finished product. I don't care who's cast in it or whatnot. So, but I mean, I don't know how many episodes they're going to do with Luther, but my feeling is look for this thing to they want it to go long term, but how are you going to do that? It doesn't work. People are going to, the press is just going to piss all over it probably because it's, bad. I don't know. I mean, there is the opportunity that it could be good. Let's be honest, but I doubt it.
Is it easier to send somebody out to acquire foreign formats and redo them than it would be to just actually work with writers to come up with new ideas? I mean, that's part of Larry's question here is just why put the effort into remaking somebody else's idea other than to be able to say, well, it worked in France or whatever.
You know what? It's the lowest common denominator answer to this is actually the correct answer, and that is they think it works elsewhere. They see it being proved. They see it. They read about it. They're familiar with the concept. They're much more comfortable with it. I know a lot about the industry, and the one thing is that no one understands what they're doing. There is no recipe for success. It's a fear-based industry. I beat that drum all the time. And this new bunch of people are like, let's get something that people know. Let's get people who make television, people who don't create it themselves, like a Matt Weiner or a David Simon. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people who at the network level who make television, and that is put it on the air. They want a franchise that's recognizable. They want a brand name. They want something that they can build a campaign around, or they want some kind of brand awareness. So that's why they go for remakes. And it's mind-boggling. I mean, we had this discussion about having this in writing my review, that the people who did The Game, this is a great series. I mean, I'm not sorry, not The Game. The Missing, this great series on Stars. It's a Missing Boy series, limited run, limited series. But those writers didn't say, oh, God, let's just do Broadchurch. They were like, okay, now we have an original idea. We're going to sell it to you. And the BBC said, yeah, we don't want another remake of something that was done. Let's give us something new. I think people should be looking for, and people in television should be looking for new ideas, new stories, creative ways to tell, a familiar story, cop, hospital, whatever it is, lawyer, new ways to tell it. And instead, they don't. They kind of knee-jerk back to something that they think has got brand recognition.
Brand recognition somewhere else, but still.
Somewhere else with a different actor and a whole different concept. So yeah, it really, really is bothersome.
Every now there's an exception that proves the rule, but they are exceptions. The Office is an exception to
The Office. Yeah, and and that's why you can't rule it out. I mean, I'm one of the big vocal haters of The Office when it started, and I didn't like those first few episodes, but once they got their own feel, once they took the concept of like, okay, we own the concept, we don't have to remake David Brenner or anything like that. I thought it turned into an excellent series, and especially when they expanded to other characters.
Right.
But so you can't rule out the fact that Luther could be, a pretty big hit if it were done right. But I honestly don't. I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, how many people have tried to remake Cracker from the original? I mean, that's just like, you can't do it. Yeah. You don't have that. You had the greatest, one of the great character actors doing that. And it's just a big, amazing person and a great writing staff. Don't bring that over to the States and ruin it.
Yeah. The latest remake of that was just a guy eating crackers on TV. It was terrible.
That's probably what it was. Exactly.
It's on the Food Network.
It's on the Food Network.
It's a guy eating crackers. They weren't even making crackers. They're just eating them. Open them, just, boxes.
That's how it gets. That's how lazy they are.
For like an hour. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Alton Brown did like the narration. He would talk about what was in the crackers. And otherwise, it was just a guy eating crackers.
It was the psychological element of it.
Well, you would wonder what cracker he might eat next if you'd put anything on the crackers. I mean, there were twists along the way. Don't get me wrong. But really, not a very strong format.
You know, no one who ever watched, if people didn't watch the original Cracker, they're not following this joke.
No, it's Robbie Coltrane. It's a that's a great show.
It's a classic. You have to watch that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't except please accept no substitutes.
Yes.
Get the British Cracker.
Especially
Robbie Coltrane.
What's his name? Who was on Murphy Brown? Murphy Brown's whatever. The guy who started that was Murphy Brown's guy who painted the interior of his house, her house. The guy who was
Robert Pastorelli.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So bad.
That was not a good show.
No.
A couple more quick ones from listeners. Frank from the 832.
Ooh, where is that? Do we know?
Texas.
Texas. Okay, not the 832.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's Houston. Just saw Lilyhammer season 3 is up on Netflix. I love it. Any thoughts?
Well, look, it's a completely inoffensive series. It's actually fun. You know, I have no ill will against Lilyhammer. I'm just kind of surprised that it's still going on, because it was. I never got the sense. And again, we don't get numbers from Netflix or Hulu or anybody else, Amazon. But I just never got the sense from them, even when you kind of are trying to suss out their a crack in their facial expression. You say, "Hey, Lilyhammer." And, you know, they're girding for you to say, "Hey, how about House of Cards? How's that doing?" You know, but like, I don't know. Isn't Lilyhammer like about as popular as Hemlock was? I don't know. Hemlock Grove.
It's a cute show.
It is fun. Whereas I don't like Hemlock Grove. I think that Lilyhammer's fun.
It's a co-production, right? So yeah. It may also be that their partner in Norway likes it and wants to keep doing it, and that makes it cheaper for them to do it. So they're like, yeah, fine, whatever.
Oh, that's absolutely it. Yes, but that's absolutely it. But creatively, I don't know. I mean, is it still? He's been over there now for a long time. So
I've only seen the first season. I thought it was great, but I didn't feel a need for more. And I'm surprised that they're still doing it.
I didn't feel a need for more either, but that doesn't mean I won't go back and watch it because I'm kind of, here's what I'm.
Is he really a fish out of water after a third season?
And that little hook that drove me crazy in the first season where he couldn't speak, right?
Norwegian, but
yeah, he could hear it.
Yeah. He could understand it.
Like fluently understand it. They could talk a mile a minute and he would get it. And then he could just speak English to them. And of course, all of them understood English.
Although that's pretty accurate. that's pretty accurate for Scandinavia, I think. You see that in Jane the Virgin, too, where the grandmother refuses to speak English, but right. She understands it just fine because nobody else speaks Spanish. They all speak English to her.
Except the difference of that is that we pull a mobster out of Jersey.
That's true.
Bring him over to Norway.
Somehow he can understand Norwegian.
Yeah, with no backstory.
Yeah, but it's a cute
I'll
show.
Check that out.
And it makes me want to mention Welcome to Sweden, which did a summer run this summer. It's a similar thing where NBC ran it mostly, I think, as a favor to Amy Poehler because it's her brother stars and wrote the show. But it's one of those things where the pressure is so low because it's a co-production with Swedish TV. And so, okay, right? It's like, why not? I watched it. I thought it was actually really cute, but nobody watched it. And it's coming back next season. I get the impression it's because it fills a time slot, it's cheap, and Swedish TV is going to make it anyway. So just, okay.
Right, right. So that's, that's coming back. And, it's one of those things where when you say Lilyhammer, I don't know. I like that there are shows that are on the air that are going to be somewhere where I can go find them. For example, Netflix just picked up, they agreed to pick up the fourth season of Longmire.
Hmm.
And I think Longmire is a really good show. But it's just one of those shows that's in the, I'm happy that Longmire is safe so that at some point when I'm ready to sit down and open that box again, I can do it because I just felt like the first season was really good. I like the characters. Katie Sackhoff in my world can do no wrong, really. She could shoot me in the eye and I would still love her as long as one of the other eyes could see how hot she was. That's the only thing about losing an eye.
That's so true love.
It's true love. And so again, Netflix has Lilyhammer. At some point, they're going to have it forever, right? So you'll go get it, and I can watch it. And now they're going to have Longmire, whereas I probably would never have found it in the A&E archives I would have had to probably really literally buy the box set off the shelf if they did it. So now I'm happy that it's somewhere, because I think there's shows like that that get lost in the mix that are maybe not the greatest, but certainly nothing to mock. And then they can be entertaining if you track them down.
That's right. The Longmire people, we mentioned that on a previous episode, and they were really excited that we were talking about Longmire, because they were really trying to get it picked up somewhere and hoping somebody would show it some love. And so,
and they did. And they did. And you know what? Longmire is one of those things where I just feel bad that I didn't stay on that bandwagon. Hmm.
One more question, another short one. This is from Max in the 925.
Ooh, the 925. We know where that is.
Yeah, that's right.
The East Bay. That's East Bay.
And he said, short answer, since I'm sure a full review is forthcoming. Well, don't be so sure. Marco Polo, yay or nay?
I can't say either way right now. A full review is coming, but Marco, it's not. I haven't done it yet.
All right.
I got to check it out, but
TBD.
I haven't done it.
Mm-hmm. We'll check back in
for a future episode. All right. We'll get that. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the listener feedback. What would you like to talk about? You mentioned to me earlier this idea of critical surprises.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of. I think people are. I don't know if they're interested or not. If my anecdotal evidence based on like questions I get and comments on Twitter, et cetera, is that they are kind of interested in kind of what. How you do your job and what decisions you make, whatever. And I try to talk about them openly. Like I really think that that Longmire was a really good series that I probably should have paid more attention to. And people who would say, "Hey, Longmire's not in the it's not in the power rankings." Let's not talk about power rankings, but they would say, "Hey, Longmire's not in the power rankings. Why not? Where's the love?" And the honest answer to that was, you know what? It fell off my radar. There were weeks I'm sure it deserved to be on there, and I just did no justice. And I think it's good to come clean about that as a critic. But this week, two things have happened that I think is kind of funny, and it's good because in a good way, people are saying, "Am I okay?" Literally, one of my bosses asked me if I was okay on Twitter, and that's. I think that you have to be, as a critic, you have to be able to have rules that you follow, but also, you know, go back. You can go back. One of my rules is that my hard and fast rule is that the world we live in, you don't get second chances. So if your show is crappy, it's crappy. I'm not going to revisit it. If there's good heritage and good people behind it and a good showrunner or creator, I will give you that second shot, but don't blow that second shot because no one gets a third shot. But I kind of tweaked that a little bit because I went back and I checked out Homeland again, and I have a very twisted, angry history with Homeland. as the people who run the show will know, and people at Showtime surely know. and that is, I thought the first season was great. I thought the second season was bad. And in fact, really, really agonizingly painful in the second half of the second season, and I thought the third season was absolutely heinous. So if you put those together, really falling off the bandwagon and complaining about it vociferously throughout the second season, and then starting the third season and me just wanting to like just strangle the whole show, there was no way I was coming back. But in the fourth season, which is now eight episodes in, longtime fans who said that they hated season three, but you know, some fans will say, "Look, torture me. I should have stopped watching this ages ago. I'm not like you. I can't just give up on it. It's on my box. I'll watch it." So longtime fans who agreed that season three was a piece of crap said, "Oh, hey, it's turned around." So I went and I watched the eight episodes that have aired now, including catching up with the one that aired on Sunday. And, you know, I wrote, it was full of caveats because I still think that given the history of Homeland, it could fall into the crapper again. And that's that. If you're keeping track at home, that's 3.5 references to crap. I went back and I was like, look, the first four episodes were flawed. I think that they showed a lot of the reasons why, you know, it's a reboot in this season four. I think they showed a lot of reasons why mistakes were made in getting rid of Brody, and that if emphasizing Carrie and her craziness was a bad idea, and all the insanity of season three left storylines that had to be addressed at the beginning of season four, which were a mistake. And then another caveat was, look, okay, they're still doing this Homeland thing, which is bothersome, where you start an idea and you want to make it a storyline, and then you lose interest in it, or you can't write it. You're just, whoever's writing that storyline doesn't have the talent to make it work. So I have those caveats. But what happened after the fourth episode was that the next four were dramatically better, particularly the last three that aired. And, you know, I know some people who are jaded about the series who have actually, I tend not to review things via link. And I get these links for upcoming shows, and I like The Walking Dead, and I just don't watch them. I want to watch them on Sunday. So people who, critic friends of mine who have actually seen this coming Sunday's Homeland say it's really good. So that would make five in a row, certainly four super strong ones. And I just thought, like, okay, you know what? This is what you do. It was a surprise to me. I went back, a show that really pushed a lot of my buttons as a critic. I went back and I had to say, look, they did well. They're trying to save themselves, and you have to give props to a show that is making an effort.
They righted the ship.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see if they did, but they certainly have so far.
Yeah.
And it was enough to sort of like pull me out of mothballs, my angry mothballs. Those are different than your regular mothballs.
Yeah. Stop the angry moths from
they do, yeah. Right. And so I checked that out. And that was a little bit surprising. And I put it up a day or two ago, and people were like, wow, never thought this was coming. In fact, I didn't tell my editor, my direct editor, for who does the review section for TV and film, that I was doing it. I just kind of banged it out. He just gets this message. He's like, what? Like, it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He's like, well, you got what? You did what? He's like, I'm happy to have it, but boy, did we not think this was coming. So that went up, and it did great. It did gangbusters business. And it's still being talked about. And then the next day, I started tweeting out, and I will do it again today, that I watched, for review purposes, which will come up in next week's magazine. It airs on December 2nd. I very, very positively reviewed a series called Bravo's first of all, it's Bravo, right? Red flag.
Right.
Bravo's first scripted series. Usually those go disastrously astray. And it's called The Girlfriend's – well, it's called – now they took the off. But Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce.
This is Marty Noxon, right?
Yeah, who I love. I love Marty Noxon, yeah. Buffy. She's – Marty Noxon is a pretty good story shepherd. She's been in she was a very big hand in Buffy.
Mm-hmm. No, she basically ran it the last couple of years, I think it was on.
And Joss really trusted her. And, you know, she was on Mad Men staff for a really long time, and Glee during the good years and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So she's very talented. I think that, but this is really her first baby. And look, you call something Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, which is based on the Vicky Iovine books. I mean, it's really not in my wheelhouse, and it's just so, everything about it says this is going to be a disaster and Tim's going to hate it. And I got to tell you, I really liked it. And in fact, my review, people haven't seen it yet. I'll just tell you in advance because it's not out yet. It's really positive. Like, I think this is one of the best shows that's directed towards women. I think men will really like it too. Anybody who's been in a relationship or married or divorced can relate to it, whether even if you're single. It's all about emotions, and it's very funny and it's very serious. But I compared it to Sex and the City in its glory years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's big.
So, it's a little bit of a shocker.
So now, that's not a rethink. That's just a surprise that it's set up for failure because you're like, the title, what's it about? It's targeted women. It's on Bravo, and you're like, oh, I may not like this. This may not be for me. And instead, you get,
loved it. Yeah, and so people are kind of. I mean, I'm still getting, because no one's seen it yet, and we're ahead. I don't think there actually has ever been a review out yet. So me tweeting about
we're starting
it,
the buzz right here.
We're starting the buzz.
Well, you started on Twitter yesterday. The buzz, critical buzz is building.
It is building.
For Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce.
And the weird thing is, because it's based on a series of books and whatnot. But I got to tell you, it's really good. This is how surprised people were. Even Leslie Goldberg, who is THR's TV reporter, and she and I really don't see eye to eye on a lot of shows. I mean, she loves all that Shonda Rhimes nonsense. I cannot stand that. So, and yesterday she tweeted out this tweet, which I mocked her about, saying, oh, if you're not watching About a Boy on NBC, you really should. It's really sweet. And I was just like, ah, vomit. And so she says, She saw my tweets. She's like, oh my God, how much wine did you have when you wrote that? How much wine were you drinking when you liked Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce? And I said to her today, I said in a tweet, I said, based solely on what you like to watch on Thursday night, you are not allowed to mock my standards. But yeah, so she's done, and that you would think that something like that's right up her alley because she likes all that soapy Shonda stuff. But I think Marty Noxon has really nailed it in this, and I'm sure when the review comes out, we'll talk more about it. But yeah, it's a shocker. I mean, everything was about it was set up to be something that I wouldn't like. So and same thing with Jane the Virgin, right? So I was saying like, okay, the year of the surprises continue. I loved a CW show like nobody's business, which is Jane the Virgin, and I still do. Mm-hmm. And I really love this Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce. And I wrote a very positive comeback story so far with caveats about Homeland. So I think people think that I fell and I hit my head.
Well, I remember you not being a huge fan of a lot of the genre shows too. And so when you came out and said that The Flash was pretty good, I'm like, wow, okay, that's a... You know, that's an endorsement because I know that's not your – that's sort of my thing, but it's not your thing. And I'm sure the people at the CW are sending you – they want to send you barrels of wine now.
Right. They're like, however he hit his head, he never recovers.
Yes. Give him a very soft hat to wear so he
just stays
this way.
Because I like Arrow too, right? Yeah. So now you have like – I've got like Arrow and Flash and – has the crossover episode aired yet? I don't know if it has.
Yeah, the one where – Well, I think they've done a couple, but the one where the computer nerd lady comes mm-hmm. and visits, and yeah, because I think we mentioned that last week that was Dr. Wave saying that's an awful lot of pretty people who are supposedly computer nerds. Yeah, well, it's a magical universe where there's like people who can run fast. It's not like our universe. Everybody's prettier there.
That's how it is at the CW. Oh, by the way, there is a great joke, by the way. This is all – see, when you talk about TV, Jason, it all comes full circle. So in Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, there is a joke about the CW because Lisa Edelstein, who plays the main character, and she's – I don't – you know, I am just like blurbing all over her because she's amazing in this. She's so good in the funny parts. She's so good in the really complicated, tender moments in the crying and the emotion parts. Her husband, they take a break. So he has an affair during the break, and it's with she finds out that it's with a CW actress. And it's a great joke, right? Because her two friends are like, oh, it's a CW actress. And there's that look on Lisa, she Googles her. But before she Googles her, she's like, she doesn't even know yet. And she looks at her, she goes, a CW actress? She goes, oh, please tell me she plays the mother. it's so great. And they handle that really well. So there you go. There's your CW.
Everybody knows her from House. She was Cuddy on mm-hmm. on House. That's probably her. I always remember her from Relativity. Do you remember Relativity?
Oh, yeah. Everything she's been in, she's very distinctive, right? She's a...
Right.
Thank God she's never mulled plastic surgery like Renee Zellweger, because then it would just destroy her original. I think she's beautiful and she's a really good actress and she's uniquely looks unique. And so she's been good in everything. But in this, I think this is her. Seriously, this is her. She's been out. She's not a coming out party for Lisa Edelstein. She's been out for a long time. But I think that this is her best work.
Wow.
Strong words, Jason.
That's a critical surprise, Tim.
I
don't know if it is. No, I love it when that happens. I mean, that's talking about Marty Noxon. I remember when I first watched the Buffy the Vampire Slayer pilot, which was like on Channel 20, right? Because that was what was airing.
That's right.
The mm-hmm. WB back then. It's like mm-hmm. obscure TV channel in the Bay Area. It's like there's never going to be something good on. It's this ridiculous title. I don't even know why I watched it other than that I don't know. I had nothing else to do. And I had that moment of like, oh, wow, I was sort of hate watching this. And it turns out that it's really good. And I love that surprise moment where something you're expecting to be bad is not. That's a great moment of discovery.
It is. And I think one of the challenges that critics face, and, you know, this could be a good column to write. And so I think one of the because there's some things that we don't talk about. And one of them is, you know, I really do not think that groupthink, so that there's two things. I don't believe that there is such a thing as groupthink, and I'm certainly not anybody that I like as a critic does not partake in that. We are all unafraid to be the only person who likes or dislikes a show. So, you know, when we're down in Los Angeles twice a year and we're all talking about TV in every single day in a hotel, you would think there could be groupthink, but there's not. There's everybody has their own opinion. So I don't really think that exists. But I do sometimes wonder if something that's far afield, something like Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, I sometimes wonder if you're going to be a magazine or something and you're going to be – and I'm not talking about like EW or some kind of fanboy nonsense. But if you're like a serious critic, I do wonder sometimes like, hey, this is really surprising on a level that I never expected this to be good. I do wonder sometimes if being first or coming out with such an opinion, you know, makes you more vulnerable or does it soften the blow for other critics who follow to say, yeah, you know, you're right. This actually is really good. Sometimes I wonder, you know, if that's true, because I think we do have, all of us have a perceived built-in bias that like something that's called The Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce is going to be as hacky as, you know, A to Z on ABC or wherever it was, you know what I mean? It's just terrible. So yeah, those are things that we, again, like Buffy is a perfect example. You talking about discovering that, like that thing fought against its title literally every moment that it was on television. And just in a lesser degree, Friday Night Lights fought against it being a teen show about football.
Right.
Right. In Texas. So it was like, it's a teen show. I don't want to watch a show about teens. It's about high school football. I don't want to watch that. No. It's about something else, but it has these other elements. All of these shows have to fight, you know, Jane the Virgin fights that. Like, wait, what? It's on the CW. It's called Jane the Virgin. She gets pregnant. How? It's about
a telenovela.
Yeah. Right? Like there's all these things that are resistant. And I think that a critic's job is to say, look, despite what it may seem, this turned out to be good. And I you know, it's just interesting. It's one of those things where I always wonder sometimes if something comes out, and I always wonder about films too. Like, is somebody going to be afraid to say they like something because everybody's going to make fun of them?
Well, it's risky when it's much easier to endorse an obscure random show. Like, if you're the first person who comes out and says Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce is great, and then one of your colleagues, you know, another critic, looks at that and is like, oh, that's interesting, and then watches it and is, you know, they're going to make their own judgment. But if they're primed to like, does that make them know that it's a little safer for them to like it, because you know, so they're not going to be the only one, they're not going to be the laughing stock. It's like, why did this person like it? Nobody else liked it. So to be to be out there when you don't know whether anybody else is going to like it, and you're kind of hanging out there. It's a fundamentally riskier thing to do than to just be one of the, you know, the masses who lines up for or against something.
Right. But it's also, I think it's also fun to be out there too. I mean, that's as a critic, it's good to be out there. Like, I go back. My relationship with the people at HBO in the early days, in the golden days, a lot of that was built on the fact that, like, I literally was one of the first male critics to like Sex and the City. And it was out there very vocally in the front saying, this is actually really good, this is very funny, et cetera. And then there's shows you can look back at and say, yeah, I was one of the first ones, but then everybody loves it, right? I mean, it's like, it's one of those things where you just were lucky enough to get out and you were in advance, or you found it. And sometimes people find shows, it's rarer these days. It's like looking for gold in the Northern California streams. It just doesn't really exist anymore. But there are people who find shows somewhere, either on a Hulu or BBC America or whatever, and they could take – I mean, again, like, I have a really great relationship with everybody on Orphan Black, because I was one of the first people who came out and said, this is a great series, and not just like, oh, it's okay, it's entertaining. No, this is really great. And this actress you've never heard of is, if she doesn't win an Emmy, something's wrong. And now we know something's been wrong for three seasons. But sometimes you can find these kind of obscure little gems, but it's harder these days. And like, I know that, like, I was excited to like Girls, and people could still argue about that. I mean, I'm sure as I write about the fourth season of Girls, people still hate on that. But these are things we sort of go deal with as critics.
I remember Roger Ebert always said that the things that he was most proud of that he did were uncovering, and he said when they were doing Siskel and Ebert, that this was he and Siskel both felt like exposing something great that nobody is ever going to hear of unless you talk about it. And like Hoop Dreams was the prime example there.
Yeah,
like that was a movie that nobody was going to see, and they championed it, and it became, lots of people saw it, and it became a successful film. And you know, I think there's something to that. Just the idea of being able to champion something and say, you know, hey, I've got a voice that carries a little further. You people should try this out. It really is good, and give it a better chance to survive.
Yeah, exactly. That I don't think there's a better feeling as a critic to do that. I mean, I would much rather write about something great and like try to alert people, like, you know, everybody, come on, you gotta watch this. No, I'm really serious. This is really good. Come on, you'll get to it. Like we did in the old days with The Wire, right? You know, pre like being able to tweet about it. You know, it's like that, I'll do another column on The Wire. It will come out in the newspaper. and then another one where my boss is like, haven't you written about this a lot? I would much rather champion a show than try to kill it. You know, there is joy in killing things. I'm not going to kid you, but I would much rather be like a Jane the Virgin right. fan or Girls or Sex in the City than to come out and just say, hey, Mulaney is really awful.
Which you did, right. You did that too. You had to do it, but
I did. You know, it's funny in retrospect, when you look back, I did so much Mulaney bashing, like in little blurbs and little capsules and tweeting, that I actually never had to do the Mulaney review. I never put the Mulaney review up, because it's like, what do I say now? I have shot this dog so many times. No one knows it's a dog or a beaver.
It becomes a vendetta at some point. Mulaney will take care of itself.
Yes. Is Mulaney a dog or a beaver? I have no idea.
Well, this has been great. I think we should end it there. We should tell people we'll come back next week for at least an abbreviated show. It's Thanksgiving week next week. But you can send your feedback to us. Tweet us at TVTM, or you can tweet us directly. I am at Jay Snell, and Tim is at Bastard Machine. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/TV Talk Machine, all one word. And you can email us at podcast@TVTalkMachine.com. Tim, it's been a pleasure as always.
As always, Jason.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.